This episode is sponsored by the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. Have you heard about the Resident Orthopedic Core Knowledge Program? The American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons has partnered with leading experts in the field to bring you ROCK, the online learning platform developed for U.S. residency programs. Free to residents, ROCK empowers you to build a foundation to prepare you for the OITE and ABOS Part 1 exam. And remember, access to the ROCK content is free for residents. Get started at rock.aaos.org. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the second episode of our Board/Citation Classics for Oncology. You know the deal. If you've been listening for a long time, this is another episode. If this is your first time listening, welcome to the podcast. You are tuned into a section of our podcast called our Board/OITE or Orthopedic In Training Exam Review, where we try to go over the high yield orthopedic surgery topics and break them down by section. And we are coming upon towards the end of all of our reviews, as we've reviewed multiple sections in the past. And now we're on oncology. So without further ado, enjoy today's episode.
You are now listening to Nailed It, the Orthopedic Surgery Podcast, featuring Drs. Jay Fitz and Wendell Cole.
So how do bone-forming tumors or ossification look like on x-ray? So we just went over cartilage matrix, but what about bone-forming tumors?
So the bone-forming tumors are, they're not going to have that ring and arcs type of calcifications. These calcifications are going to be more kind of cloud-like. Some of the osteosarcomas that I've seen and treated, it's like you have a picture of a distal femur up and then somebody stuck like cotton balls inside the bone and tried to take an x-ray of that. And you can just kind of see that osteoid that's calcifying in a haphazard manner. And so it's not the same mature-like calcifications that you can see with more of the cartilage-forming tumors. This is like, this tumor doesn't quite know what to do. There's lytic regions, but there's also these blastic cloud-like calcifications. You can also see like a soft tissue mass with mineralization, especially in like a osteosarcoma, which has that stuck on appearance. And then always think in a adolescent bone forming tumor is going to be osteosarcoma until proven otherwise. So that's a like an easy kind of test taking trick, is they're always going to say that she's 14 years old, she's probably a soccer player, she probably has pain and can't keep up with her teammates anymore. And then you see this distal femur that has cloud-like calcifications in it. It's osteosarcoma. And that's what the test is going to want you to know. So some of these things should be like knee-jerk reactions. Don't even think about it. You know, based on the age and the appearance, it's osteosarcoma. And then there are some tumors where you can see some internal trabeculations on x-ray. What are some of those?
Yeah, so these are going to be tumors like giant cell tumors, non-ossifying fibromas, and hemangiomas. And for those listening, don't worry. Later on, we're going to talk about all these tumors, but this is just, you know, repetition is key. So we're starting off by repeating these multiple times so you hear them. So again, tumors with internal trabeculations, giant cell tumor, non-ossifying fibromas, hemangiomas, and, you know, next to an area of tumor, you can have either your residual trabeculae or you can have new bone that's going to be forming, again, due to that adjacent tumor. So what are some examples of periosteal reactions seen with tumors? We mentioned some of these a little bit earlier, and we'll just mention it again for completeness sake.
Yeah, so periosteal reactions, you can have the continuous ones, which are basically the bone or the periosteum was able to form a new calcified layer around the tumor that is growing, and it's one continuous band. You'll see it on an AP or a lateral projection, and that is more reassuring for a tumor that while it may be expanding outside of the bone, it's not growing so fast that the periosteum can't keep up with it. But when you have things like interrupted periosteal reactions, so you have the like the hair on end or the sunburst appearance where it looks like there's these thin little lines that are perpendicular to the surface of the bone, that basically means that this tumor is growing so rapidly that the periosteum is trying to contain it. These kind of hairs on end or these sunburst type patterns are failing to keep up with this tumor as it's continuing to grow. And then the lamellated or the onion skinning type ones are the every time the bone tries to contain it with a layer of periosteum and calcification, the tumor breaks through that. And then you get another layer, tumor breaks through that, and you get another layer. And so you'll see three or four separate lines of periosteum that have tried to contain this tumor, but it just keeps outgrowing it each time. And then the Codman triangle is basically where normal periosteum starts on the bone surface, but the tumor is pushing the rest of that periosteum off, and you get that calcification within that acute angle from the bone cortex to the periosteum, and you get a triangle of bone formation, and that's what a Codman triangle is. So yeah, so think bone tumors, if it's not well-defined and it's not geographic, it probably is a bad thing. That's a quick and easy way of knowing these on the OIT and on the ABOS. And so what is a clue that you can use to differentiate like a periosteal reaction between an infections versus like Ewing sarcoma?
Yeah, this is some of the similar stuff that you're just talking about. So with like infection or, you know, possible cases of Langerhans cell histiocytosis, you'll have that single thick layer of periosteal reaction, which is, again, is more likely to be benign versus in Ewing sarcoma, you have the lamellated or that onion skinning periosteal reaction, which is more likely to be malignant. Now, what are some other things that you can note in x-rays in different tumors? Because we went over how cartilage forms or how cartilage looks like on x-rays, how bone forming tumors look like on x-rays. What are some other things that we can see in different types of tumors?
So just like we have the like periosteal reactions, that we can have things that happen on the inside of the bone. So we can call that endosteal scalloping. And sometimes this can happen with a benign enchondroma if it is a more eccentric lesion, but it's basically, and this also kind of goes back to what is the tumor doing to the bone and what is the bone doing to the tumor. So endosteal scalloping basically means that the tumor is starting to erode the endosteum. And while the outer cortex is fully intact, you'll see these kind of scalloping lesions from the inside of the cortex. And usually if it's just endosteal scalloping, but the cortex is intact, that's benign. But if you see endosteal scalloping and some of the scalloping is through the cortex itself and starting to protrude in a soft tissue manner, that is a more malignant lesion. So think like enchondroma is the benign version versus like a chondrosarcoma is the malignant version. Like on Thursday, I have a chondrosarcoma because it's half the tumor is well contained, and but it has endosteal scalloping. But then the inferior half of the tumor, that endosteal scalloping has now turned into a soft tissue expansion. I got it biopsied and it came back as chondrosarcoma. So that's just like kind of the real life usefulness of this, kind of knowing what these terms are. Then you can have punched out lesions like a multiple myeloma, sometimes metastasis, but that's usually not the case. Punched out is usually multiple myeloma, or a younger patient is going to have that Langerhans cell histiocytosis. And then the ground glass appearance, I don't know. I wasn't around in the 80s when they came up with all this terminology. It's hard for me to see a lot of the times, but ground glass, think of it like the frosted glass windows at, you know, fancy restaurant or whatever. That's kind of what the internal part of the bone looks like. And it is what it is. I don't really go off of ground glass appearances too much, but that's what if a question stem says the femur has a slightly expanded cortex with a ground glass appearance, just think fibrous dysplasia, check the answer and move on. So what are some of the other modalities that can be attained to help diagnose and stage tumors?
Yeah. So, and again, just to make the distinction for those that are listening, we're talking about staging. We're talking about kind of the extent of the cancer and, you know, if it's spread versus grading, it was kind of more like kind of local or how bad, you know, what it
looks like.
Yeah, exactly. So some things that we can use to help stage tumors, one's going to be a CT scan, which also is good to help diagnose different tumors such as osteoid osteoma. because, you know, you can see those pretty well on CT scan. And classically, the questions that I've seen has been like a coronal CT cut of like a, you know, of like the femur or some bone, and you'll see like that little sclerotic area. And so that's one thing to know for the CT scans. MRI, the entire bone that's involved. So you want to evaluate for any soft tissue masses. And so you can use different weighted images. So the T1 weighted images are great for evaluating the anatomy, and the T2 weighted images are great for evaluating pathology. You can do a whole body technetium 99 bone scan. You can do the 18 FDH. I'm not going to say the whole thing because I think we said it at some point before. Glucose scan. And what that is, it's measuring the glucose, because the glucose is going to be transported intracellularly in areas where there's increased metabolic activity, such as tumors. You can do PET scans, which are useful for lymphomas, a CT chest that can help evaluate for metastases, as well as some labs. And we'll touch base a little bit later on a lot of some of these different lab values to order in different situations. But continuing on with just some oncologic principles, what are just the different types of biopsies?
This episode is sponsored by the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. Are you an orthopedic resident? Then you need to know about ROC. It's a new resident orthopedic core knowledge program developed by the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. Created for U.S. residency programs and free to residents, ROC covers 11 subspecialties and is filled with in-depth, comprehensive content and quizzes that have been authored and vetted by some of the leading experts in orthopedics. This all-in-one curriculum will give you the foundation and knowledge you need to become a successful, board-certified orthopedic surgeon. And remember, access to ROC content is free to residents. Get started at rock.aaos.org.
Yes, so you have a needle biopsy, which can either be a fine needle aspiration versus a core needle biopsy. A fine needle aspiration is useful for things like thyroid cancer. It's the gold standard biopsy for thyroid. But for bone and soft tissue sarcomas, it is not the standard. Just because the fine needle biopsy, it just aspirates tumor cells. It doesn't give you the actual structural makeup of the tumor, which a lot of sarcomas, the main differentiating factor is the actual architecture of the tumor itself. Is it on a myxoid background? Is it in a fibrous background? Is it in a bony background? Is it in a cartilaginous background? And you don't get that sense with a fine needle aspiration, but you do with a core needle biopsy. And so a core needle biopsy is now kind of the gold standard for bone and soft tissue sarcomas, because you actually take an entire core of the tumor and you get to see what the actual structural makeup is of the tumor. Sometimes an open incisional biopsy is necessary for me personally, because I'm the only orthopedic oncologist and I'm the first orthopedic oncologist in my area. We don't have a great system yet set up for expedited biopsies. And so an easier way for me to get my biopsies done faster is to do an incisional biopsy. And that's taking a patient to the operating room, making an incision in line with your proposed incision. Should it be a malignant tumor, you do a intramuscular, you don't go between the muscles. You go inside a single muscle itself, because if it's a malignancy, you don't want to contaminate multiple muscles or multiple compartments. You want to go in a direct fashion to the tumor and get your sample that way, close them up, and then get your pathologist to read it, do all their tests or whatever. And then there's an excisional biopsy, which is mainly done for smaller masses, whether they're benign or malignant, or larger benign things like a larger lipoma or something that looks like a atypical lipomatous tumor on MRI. I'll just do an excisional biopsy of that. And that's basically, you just take out the entire mass and send that to pathology before you have a true diagnosis of it. And so what are some of the incisional biopsy principles? I went over one of them. What are some of the others?
Yeah. So one was kind of just like you just mentioned, using the same incision as a planned resection. And maybe we can talk about this. So we're, you know, on our notes here, we have that core needle biopsy has a lower chance of recurrence within the biopsy tract if the biopsy is not removed. So we're saying, for example, if the interventional radiologist performs a biopsy and they do a core needle that's not planted in the incision line, only around 2% of the tumors recur at the biopsy tract. How often are the interventional radiologists doing it? And then are they doing it in line where you eventually want, or y'all typically have a discussion beforehand? I know everything's not set up, but ideally kind of in your experience, what have you seen?
Yeah. So where I did my fellowship, they had a 30-year track record of orthopedic oncologists working there. And so the oncologists or the surgeons and the interventional radiologists doing the biopsy over the years, basically the radiologists were like, oh, okay, we know where the incision's going to be. And so that's where we're going to do our core needle biopsy. And I mean, it comes down to the fact that like I've done lectures with my interventional radiologist of like, hey, these are the common places I'm going to ask you to biopsy. These are the common incisions that I use. If you can, try and do something within this sort of path. It doesn't have to be exact, but it would be nice to be somewhere close. And then it's just having open communication with them. Basically, they'll call, hey, I have Mr. Smith here. I see his tumors in the posterior femur, but are you planning on doing an anterior approach to the leg to get this tumor out? And I'll say, yeah. And they're like, well, it would be easier to get to the mass if we went like posterior lateral. And if they do that, then I just make sure that they mark out where they did their biopsy so that I can either excise the tract at the time of surgery or at least just keep that in mind for as I follow patients in the course of their treatment, because there is such a low chance of recurrence, but it's not zero. So it is a little bit tougher. And then if I can get a patient in to see an interventional radiologist within a week, I'll actually take a Sharpie in clinic and I'll mark where my incision is going to be so that by the time they get to the interventional radiologist, it's still going to be on their skin so they know kind of where to go. But it's fairly low. It's less than 2% of the time, but it's still not zero. So it's something you have to be careful for.
Okay. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Okay. So, and then finishing off the rest of the question you asked were the incision biopsy principles, like you just said, in line with the planned resection, longitudinal incisions may be transverse to the clavicle. Although I've heard some just doing the workhorse approach with the saber tooth, I'm blanking on the actual approach for the shoulder that I've heard a lot of oncology surgeons use. It's just like a vertical incision that goes up over the clavicle, over the trapezius, and then back all the way down the scapula. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What's the name of that again?
I don't know the name of it, but okay. It's kind of like it's a deltopec until you get to the coracoid, and then it goes superior over the acromioclavicular joint, and then it turns into like a posterior approach to the scapula. We had one guy who had a chondrosarcoma of his scapula, and he had that kind of really massive incision that went up and over the top of the shoulder.
Okay. All right. And then so you also want to avoid critical structures. You want to biopsy the soft tissue component of the tumor, and you want to do an intramuscular approach. So you don't want to contaminate other compartments. And I've seen this come up on like an exam or questions where they'll show you like an axial cut of whatever they're trying to show you and tell you to choose which tract to go through. You know, one is like maybe just directly anterior. Say you're looking at a thigh and the tumor is like just in the anterior quads or something. They'll have one line going just directly anterior. They'll have one going medial, like right next to the vessels, or, you know, they'll have it going in other places. And you want to go with an intramuscular approach. So you don't necessarily want to go through like two different intervals, like the deltopec, for example. You may just go through the anterior deltoid instead. And then you also want to obtain hemostasis.
We hope that y'all enjoyed that episode. We hope you learned a little bit about some more oncology. And we hope that you are following us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and now TikTok at Nailed It Ortho. All right, everybody, until next time.